Stanford University. I've known him since 1962 when I first took a course from him, and he was later my thesis advisor. He introduced me to Navier-Stokes equations, but at the same time took up the study of capillary surfaces, which he is still studying. I think this is all done by now. Maybe this will complete the whole theory. But
it's not likely. Yeah, I've been on capillary surfaces for quite a while. When I first went to it, I thought it was just going to be an interlude, just a period in which I wanted a brief change. But it seems to have it turned out to be something more than that. It has taken over, and, well, I think there are still things left to do, and I hope to make that point today. I want to say that I'm very deeply pleased to have the chance once more to speak at UBC in this wonderful city, and of course to have contact with old friends here. I want to consider a physical problem that can be traced at least as far back as medieval times, and that throughout the 18th century was a source of major attention for the world's most celebrated scientists. The activities of that century, of the 18th century, filled 100 years with intensive efforts that were largely fruitless. The best results that were obtained were off by a factor of two or more from from experiments that could be relatively easily made in the laboratory. But the turn of the century, from the 18th to the 19th century, saw spectacular initial successes that by the standards of the time were definitive, and the general impression seems to have spread that there was then nothing else left to do. There followed a period of almost 100 years of quiescence, in which, well, it was quiescence from the point of view of doing new things. There was still activity in the sense that people were writing expository articles and even a number of books, books by famous celebrated scientists appeared. On the other hand, during that period, essentially nothing new was contributed to the theory. But as the 20th century approached, There was again a spurt of activity, and a number of rather striking new results appeared in a technical sense. There were no fundamental changes, but some very technically interesting things were done. Well, that was a brief period, and then the problem somehow died, and it was largely forgotten until fairly recently, when it was revived again in some new contexts. This time, quite definitive new achievements again appeared, and in some senses a new plateau seems to have been reached, or there was, one could imagine that a new plateau, one gets the impression, looking at the material, that somehow a new plateau was reached, and that the fundamental new insights have had their impact. One of the things I want to do in this talk is to show that anyone who thinks that the new plateau was actually reached should in fact think again, that there are in fact not only new things waiting to be done, but in fact quite significant new mysteries have appeared that are waiting to be clarified. And after that elaborate introduction, I think I should show you what the problem is. Let me be fairly specific about that. Let's see, I'm using this one. is this? Yeah. Does that work? Yeah. Focus perfectly. One takes an infinite bath of liquid and then dips a cylindrical tube into the liquid. Let's say one can start, as indicated in the picture, I'm going to take a circular cylindrical tube and dip that into the liquid. And as was first observed centuries earlier, depending on the materials, the liquid may rise in the tube. For example, if the liquid is water and the tube is of glass, the liquid will definitely rise in the tube. And the problem, as considered in the 18th century, was to find a quantitative formula to determine the height of rise. In fact, the interest centered at that time on being able to get a formula for the height at the center, for the rise height at the center of the tube. The physical boundary condition that became known clearly during that century was that the liquid meets the bounding walls in what's called the triple interface, and it meets that wall in an angle gamma. I've drawn the normals to the two surfaces, and this contact angle gamma is a physical quantity which depends only on the materials. It depends in no way on the shape of the solution surface. It does not depend on the gravity field, and it does not depend on the thickness of the bounding walls. That's something which, an angle that has to be measured independently from some independent experiment, and then it's put into this problem. The rise height will depend very much on what that angle is, but that has to be taken as a physical constant. What was observed since early times is that if one replaces the tube with a larger tube, then the rise height in the liquid is much smaller in the larger tube. The rise height goes down very rapidly as the radius of the tube increases. And the first quantitative expression that made sense and was consistent with experiments was this formula due to Thomas Young in 1805, that the rise height at the center is twice the surface tension divided by the density change across the surface times the gravitational acceleration times the radius of the tube and multiplied by the cosine of the contact angle. This was Young's celebrated formula. It corresponded to the best experiments that could be made at the time and gave a reasonably good correspondence. The formula is, in fact, asymptotically correct as the radius of the tube goes to zero. Remarkably, the first proof of that was not given until almost 200 years after Young presented his formula. The first proof was given by David Siegel in 1980 as part of his Stanford University dissertation, and I'll lay claim to the second, somewhat better proof about 5 years after Siegel's proof. This formula is asymptotically correct as the radius A goes to zero. The formula becomes really very much wrong as A tends to increase. As soon as the diameter of the tube is large enough so that it can be discerned with the naked eye, the formula is way off by many magnitudes. The actual decay to zero is exponential rather than just like 1 over A, and exponential with big constants. In any event, this formula says this is asymptotic, and it turns out to be asymptotic for small a, and that turns out to be correct. That still doesn't say that the U0 decreases monotonically with increasing a. But in fact, that turns out to be true, and again, that was not proved until very recently. That, in fact, the derivative of U0 with respect to A is actually zero for the presumably exact solution. Well, one can say a little bit more.
The derivative is zero?
Is it, Did I say zero? No, the derivative is negative.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, less than zero. Excuse me. So one can say a little bit more. Let's make the following experiment. I'm going to start with a tube of small radius, and I put that into the liquid bath. Then I look every place along here, I get a symmetric solution. It can be proved, in fact, that the exact solution is symmetric. It's not entirely trivial, but it's true. In fact, the proof that there exists a solution is already fairly recent. The first one appeared, even for this symmetric case, I think the first formal proof didn't appear until the 1960s or 70s. But let's look at the solution surface at the height of rise, every place along a radius going from the center to the boundary. Let's remember where that height was. Then I'm going to remove that tube and replace it by a symmetric larger tube. And I'm going to compare the heights not only at the center, but every place along that radius. And it turns out, again, that the center height is everywhere higher than that of the outer tube. Again, that was first proved only fairly recently, but it's true. I hope it's true. Mm-hmm. We can say still more than that. Let's put this small tube here at this point, make the measurements on the small tube, remove the tube, and then place the large tube down in this way, as I've indicated, and then compare the heights again over this section. And the comparison is still goes the same way. The liquid in the small tube is at every point higher than the liquid that we find in the larger tube. That is not so obvious. The first case was something one would immediately expect. It's not so clear that should be expected in this case, but it's true. And again, the first proof was given by David Siegel in 1980 as consequence of a much more general and very interesting theorem. I'll come back in a moment to the actual theorem. Well, with considerations of this sort in mind, about 30 years ago, Mario Miranda raised the following general question. Let's take a tube of any section, not necessarily symmetrical, just any section omega zero, dip that into the liquid, look at the rise height everywhere over that section, then remove the tube, replace it by a larger section that strictly contains the original one, again make the experiment and measure the heights, and compare the heights over this section omega zero. Is the height over the inner section everywhere larger than the height over the outer one? It's possible to make the comparison only over the inner section. Well, that was a question raised by Miranda. It created a fair amount of interest, and a number of particular cases were considered. I'll mention a couple of particular cases. One case was considered by David Siegel. He said that if the inner section is circular, and if it's possible to move the circular intersection so as to contact any point of the boundary with that circular section still lying interior to the outer one, if that is possible, then the answer is yes. Then the inner one always raises liquid higher than does the outer one over its section, no matter where the inner one is situated.
So that's independent of the perimeter of the tube?
It's independent of anything except the possibility to contact any point with the inner circle so that the circle lies entirely in the outer domain. That's the only requirement made by Siegel. He assumed boundary smoothness. That's a quite beautiful theorem, and it contains this previous theorem that I indicated. This previous theorem is a special case because we can clearly contact any boundary point with the inner circle, with the inner circle still inside. But, of course, the general theorem is of quite broader interest. I was able to prove that if the outer domain is circular, then the answer is again everywhere yes. If the boundary angle is zero, then it's not difficult to prove that the answer is always yes. And a number of other particular cases were considered at that time. I won't go into all of them. I think, let's see. Didn't I have another? I didn't. Okay. I want to consider this problem and, give some indication of what one might be able to say about it.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Separate experiments, isn't it? Not one, two, physically inside the other.
These are two distinct experiments. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You make the experiment with one tube, you remember the result, then you make the experiment with the other tube and compare the results. Well, as you've all doubtless surmised by now, I've been leading you on, and I'm intending today to show that the answer in general is not yes, but maybe. The answer can change, and can change in what were for me some rather surprising ways. The answer can change in very sharply discontinuous ways with infinitesimal change in the configuration of the tubes. In order to do that, I'm going to have to resort to the actual equations. This is something that still continues to amaze me. It struck me already when I was a graduate student. It continues to strike me now that we're interested in finding global information. And in order to find global information, we write down things that depend on microscopically tiny information. We write down differential equations, which involve second-order differentials, which involves extremely microscopic considerations. And then we sum these differentials, so we convert the microscopic information into global information. And why this works, I don't know. Why one should have to do it, I don't know. But it is a magic technique. It does work. I'm going to write down the formal equation. Divergence of a vector operator Tu is a constant B times U with Tu is the gradient of U over the square root of 1 plus gradient U squared. And this is in the domain. And nu dot Tu is equal to cosine of the boundary angle on what I'll call sigma equal to the boundary of omega. Here, nu is the unit exterior normal to the boundary. It's a deceptively simple-looking equation. It looks simple until you try to get information out of it. And then you discover that, that things are not always as easy as they seem at first. I should remark that in the three-dimensional case in which one is chiefly interested, if B is greater than... Oh, I should have said what B is. I'm sorry. Let's see. B... I've written the equation in non-dimensional form, which I think is in general the most convenient way to do it. B is given by rho g over sigma times a squared. It's a non-dimensional parameter. And in general, let's see, in general we don't have a radius to work with. A can be any representative length that appears in the problem, and we might take this just to be the diameter of the domain, regardless of the shape of the domain. And here, the u that appears in this equation is to be interpreted as the ratio of the actual height u to this representative length A. So we should consider it in that form. And let's see, B going to zero is equivalent to gravity going to zero. And there are many advantages to considering this in a non-dimensional form. Well, that's the differential equation. And as I've indicated, to get information out of this, we have to start integrating this equation. Yeah.
So what does mu represent?
It's the height, the rise height, divided by the representative length A. This equation was, in a sense, known to Young, although, let's see, Young was irrevocably opposed to the use of mathematical symbols. In his paper giving the rise height, that did not appear as an equation. Everything was written out in words. It's astonishing that he was able to do it, but somehow he did, and as far as I can make out, it's correct. The equation was first written in this form by Laplace. It should be remarked that this expression, divergence of Tu, is exactly twice the mean curvature of the surface. So we really have a geometric problem. We have to find a surface whose mean curvature is known in terms of the rise height of the surface, and which makes a prescribed angle gamma with the boundary walls. So it's completely geometrical in that sense.
Again, what is nu?
Nu is the exterior unit normal.
Oh,
our,
okay,
our domain is like this. Nu. And here's omega. And A is a representative length. I might take, say, the diameter of the domain, the maximum width, and measure A in that way. There are many possible choices for choosing A. Well, these two equations can be looked at from a more modern point of view. I can combine them into a single relation, to a single integral relation. And I can do that in the following way. I multiply the equation by a test function eta, and then I integrate over the domain. And we get formally, then I apply the divergence theorem, and I get the integral over omega of, gradient of the test function eta dot tu plus b mu eta is equal to the boundary integral over that boundary of eta times tu, times tu dot nu, but tu dot nu is cosine of gamma. So I just get eta cosine of gamma ds. This gives, instead of those two conditions, we have now just a single relation. And this is to hold for all eta, and that the choice of class for eta here is essential. I know only one class that works. It works in an ideal sense. Any other class I choose, there's always some reason why it won't work. Eta is to belong to the class L infinity of omega intersect W11 of omega. It's a non-reflexive space. Well, something rather remarkable has happened here. The boundary condition involves derivatives of the unknown function u. But in this relation here, no derivatives of u on the boundary appear. In fact, not only don't derivatives of u on the boundary appear, but even u itself on the boundary doesn't appear. So no boundary information on the function u that we want as a solution actually is required for applying this formula. And nevertheless, it's turned out that this formula suffices for determining a unique solution in many cases of general interest. And that was due to a paper due to Michaela Emmer in 1973. And he could consider, in general, piecewise smooth domains. Any sort of domain roughly like this. Well, let's see. There was a restriction in Emmer's paper, but the restriction was removed in a later paper that I wrote with Gerhard. And so one can consider a general piecewise smooth domain. Take this to be my omega. And we see that for such a domain, the boundary condition in this form, in this form, cannot be prescribed at these corner points. But that doesn't matter in this formulation. And it turns out that for any such domain, if B is positive, I'm going to put in here the requirement B positive. That corresponds to a vertically downward gravity field. If B is positive, there exists always a unique function U, which is smooth interior to the domain, and for which this relation holds for every eta in this class. Such a function U is uniquely determined. That tells you nothing at all about the behavior on the boundary, but no growth condition need be applied at these points. The solution is completely determined independent of growth conditions, and one can say whenever a smooth solution exists up to the boundary, that solution is identical to the one that we have found here. That the solution we found here is identical to the smooth solution. And again, nothing has to be said. No boundary condition is imposed at these corner points on the domain. Well, now I'm going to be interested in these solutions. Well, I'll give this a label. I want to call this a variational solution. And variational solution means simply that U is smooth interior to the domain, satisfies this relation for any such eta. I want to consider such solutions for values of B that are small. And here I get immediately into some trouble, because it can be shown in general that if the B goes to zero, then the rise height is going off to infinity, no matter what domain I take. So I lose the solution. It disappears out to infinity. We can get around that difficulty in a somewhat sneaky way. I'm going to replace the problem. Well, maybe I should... that's correct. It's all right as I have it. I'm going to replace the problem by this one. I'm going to take a cylindrical tube closed at the bottom. So I'm going to remove... I won't consider an infinite bath anymore. I just take a single cylindrical tube, close it at the bottom, and fill it partly with a prescribed volume of liquid. So I replace it with a problem that has a volume constraint. And I look for that surface. In that case, this equation gets replaced by divergence Tu is equal to Bu plus a constant, which I'll write as 2h, where 2h is the Lagrange parameter coming from the volume constraint. In this form, we can let B go to zero. So I want to let B tend to zero. We can somehow do it conceptually in the sense that if the volume is constrained, the solution can't disappear entirely. There has to be at least some set in here where the solution stays within bounds, and we can at least continue to examine the surface over that set. So we let the B go to zero, and this leads to a new equation, which I'll write down here. B goes to zero from the top equation, and I get divergence Tu equal to H. And this is known as the zero gravity capillary equation corresponding to surfaces of constant mean curvature. Again, I can write the expression the boundary condition stays the same. And again, I can combine the equation with the boundary condition, and I get that the integral over omega of gradient, gradient eta dot t. I'm going to change notation here. For solutions of this problem, I'm going to replace u by capital U. So I get plus, 2H eta dx is equal to the integral over the boundary of omega of eta cosine gamma. And again, I'll refer to variational solutions. I'll take the same class, eta, belonging to L infinity, intersect W 1, 1. So I'll refer to variational solutions of this problem. Well, at this point, we're ready for the first theorem. I want to compare solutions of this problem with solutions of this problem. So I'm going to look at the configurations with small gravity and try to compare them in some sense with solutions for zero gravity. Now those are really two quite different problems, and direct comparison is not so easy, but we can get a theorem which in somehow reflects the interrelationship between those problems. Because the problems are not entirely independent. And I'll write this as theorem one. Suppose there exists a solution capital U. By capital U, I mean a solution of the of this problem with the 2H on the right-hand side. Okay. And suppose that small m less than capital U less than big M. The two m's to be finite numbers. Let U of x be a variational solution of the original equation okay, in omega. And I'm going to set A equal to the measure of omega and P equal to the measure of boundary omega. Okay. Then throughout the domain omega there holds U of X minus 1 over B times P over A cosine gamma is less than M minus M. So that says whenever there is such a solution, U minus this thing, well, is uniformly bounded throughout the domain and bounded explicitly by this quantity. Let's see, the geometrical interpretation should be remarked here. This quantity which appears here is exactly the average value of U over the domain. So this measures the difference between U and its average value and says that difference isn't too large. On this theorem, I'm ready to rest my case for the importance of existence theorems in applied mathematics. This theorem depends on the existence of this solution capital U, even though capital U does not appear explicitly in this relation. There is no capital U appearing in this relation, only in an indirect way through bounds on that capital U. But in general, solutions capital U do not exist. If you give me any reasonable contact angle gamma, I can construct for you without difficulty a convex analytic domain for which there will be no solution capital U of that other equation. What happens physically is that in zero gravity, if there are points of locally large boundary curvature, the solution surface simply disappears up to infinity throughout the region near that
point. Why doesn't
point.
That always happen in zero gravity?
It doesn't. With a boundary constraint, the you've asked exactly the right question. We have a volume constraint, so the solution can't disappear everywhere to infinity. And in fact, in some cases, everything is perfectly okay. The theorem is not vacuous. There are many interesting situations in which the solution's capital U exists. Specifically, I take a domain that looks like this, a very eccentric ellipse perhaps, and I can exclude the existence. One can show that there are whole regions here in which the solution surface goes off to infinity. But if I take a circle, if my omega has a circular shape, then I can even get an explicit capital U for any contact angle gamma. All I have to do is take a lower circular cap that meets the boundary in the prescribed angle.
I missed the boundary, the volume constraint. I thought this was sitting in an infinite value.
No, for the solution small u of this problem, this corresponds to the infinite bath.
Yes.
But this one is a completely different problem.
Oh.
This one is a problem corresponding to a single tube closed at the bottom in which we put a prescribed volume of fluid. They're really I'm comparing solutions of two very different problems.
Yeah. I assume that A, being the volume of the liquid, reflects the H parameter, or that they would have been related between solutions.
No, they're not related. The H is completely determined by the geometry of the domain.
By the
it's not a no. The H is independent of volume. And that arises for the reason, you can see this immediately, if you take a solution with a given volume, increase the volume, the surface simply rises up rigidly, but the H stays the same. You get the identical, the form of the solution is independent of the volume. The H is completely determined by the geometry of the base domain. In fact, I can calculate H for you immediately. I take this equation, I integrate it over the domain, and I get 2H times omega is equal to the integral of divergence TU by the divergence theorem. That's equal to nu dot TU integrated on the boundary, and that's simply equal to the boundary of omega times cosine gamma. And we can calculate H from this relation.
Which depends then on the volume omega.
No, omega is the area. Omega is the area of the base domain. It's the area of a section of the cylinder. Okay. So the volume doesn't appear in this formula. So the H that appears here is not arbitrary. It's completely determined by the geometry. And there may or may not exist a solution of that equation. But here is a case where a solution does exist. So there are some cases where solutions exist. Another case where solutions exist, I can take the domain as a square, and I'll take a circle circumscribed about the square. I'll take a lower hemisphere under this circle. That lower hemisphere intersects these four boundary walls, always in the constant contact angle, gamma equal pi over 4. We can see that angle here. The angle gamma appears at this point and also at this point. And that's the constant angle with which the lower hemisphere intersects these walls. So for gamma equal pi over 4, we can get, again, an explicit solution for this problem. And, in fact, I can get any larger gamma by taking a concentric hemisphere. I can get any gamma equal to or larger than pi over 4 and get an explicit solution. But gamma less than pi over 4, we cannot construct a solution this way. And, in fact, I can prove that if gamma is less than pi over 4, there is no solution to this problem. So here is a case in which, depending on gamma, we may or may not be able to get a solution of the constant curvature problem. If a solution, capital U, fails to exist, then this theorem becomes wrong. It makes no sense at all. There's simply no theorem of this sort. So this explicit bound is reduced to an auxiliary existence theorem. And we'll have to face that problem. Well, the proof of the theorem is not basically very difficult. I don't see a clock. I have a feeling I'm not going to have time to include it, so I'm going to...
We're about 45 minutes into
talk. Okay. I'm going to have to leave the proof of the theorem as an exercise. Okay. I want to look now at a particular example. I'm going to take the inner domain to be a circular disk of radius 1, and the outer domain, one should really give this talk at Christmas time. The outer domain is a nicely shaped star, but it's a star with particular properties. I demand particular properties of this star. It has to be constructed in a special way. These three conditions have to be satisfied. The polygon must strictly contain the disk. It must be star-shaped with respect to the center of the disk. And all of the sides have to extend to tangents to the boundary. It's not hard to see that given a disk, you can construct as many such star domains as you want. I assert this star domain has nice properties. First of all, let's see. This result, if we look at this result, we see that given cosine gamma, then the asymptotic behavior of U as B goes to zero is completely controlled by the ratio of P over A. And so in order to find the bounds for the behavior of U, I just have to know what P over A is. Now, for small u, for the solution interior to the disk, I'm going to start again. For the interior disk, let's calculate P over A. I'll call that P0 over A0 for the interior disk. That's not too difficult. I think the boundary is 2 pi times the radius, and the area is pi, so I get 2. How about this ratio for the outer domain? It may look frightening at first, but it's not difficult. I take a look at this. Let's see, the P star, I guess I'll write as sigma LJ star, the sum of the boundary lengths.
So A is 1. A is 1.
The radius
is 1.
Yes. I've chosen the inner radius to be 1. Yeah. Now, P star here is the sum of the boundary lengths, and I can calculate the A, it's not difficult. To each of these boundary lengths, I can construct a triangle like this, and the total area is the sum of the areas of these triangles. But here I have, the height of the triangle is 1, and the base is, the altitude of the triangle is 1, the base is the length. So this area is exactly half the length. So A star is equal to 1/2 sigma LJ star. And so P star over A star is equal to 2. I get the same P over A for the disk as for the star. That means the asymptotic behavior is the same, and the triangle inequality tells me immediately something important was left out. I have to know the existence of solutions of the zero gravity problem for both of these. I'll come to that. But so assuming that existence, I get that U minus capital U is going to be less than a fixed constant independent of B. Simply by use of the triangle inequality. I have to show that I have existence for the zero gravity problem for both cases. And let's take a look at that. I've repeated the same figure. And to simply take any disk that completely contains the both domains, and I looked at each of these vertical planes here intersects that thing in the same angle gamma, because all of these tangents are equidistant from that center point. For any such gamma, whenever we take such a disk completely containing the configuration, for that, corresponding to that gamma, I take a lower hemisphere, and the radius will be 1 over cosine gamma. That gives me an explicit solution in this outer domain, in the star domain, corresponding to the angle gamma. Okay. And in fact, that the identical explicit solution is also an explicit solution with that angle gamma for the inner disk. So for both domains, I get an explicit solution by the same construction. I have to limit myself to gammas constructed in this way. So for all such gamma, I do get solutions. I can find them explicitly. I think we're ready for the next theorem. I hope I'm not going to run out of time too soon. So I get that result, but I sharpen that result. Theorem 2 is that U zero is greater than U, than the U in the star domain. That is the, for given B, or for B greater than zero, any B greater than zero, the solution in here is at each point higher than the solution we get for the star out here. That tells us that the question raised by Miranda has a positive answer for this construction, has a positive answer for any B. That perhaps shouldn't come as a surprise. It's a new result. It doesn't come out of Siegel's theorem because this disk can't be moved to contact high up in here. But it's certainly not a surprise that we get an affirmative answer in this case. I need 2 minutes more. I need the surprise. What for me was the big surprise is that if instead of taking this inner circle, I take a slightly larger circle of radius 1 plus epsilon, and I consider the solution in that domain, I can get, again, an explicit solution of the zero-gravity problem there. And in that domain, well, that same lower hemisphere won't do anymore. I have to take a hemisphere of slightly larger radius. And I'm going to call that P epsilon over A epsilon. And that turns out to be 2 over 1 plus epsilon, which is less than 2. And that has the asymptotic behavior. So U epsilon is asymptotic to 2 over 1 plus epsilon times 1 over B cosine gamma. And U star is asymptotic to 2 over 1 plus epsilon 1 over B cosine gamma. And this tells me, two times that. This tells me if B is small, implies that U star minus U epsilon, well, not only is U star greater than U epsilon, giving a negative answer to the Miranda question, but it's tending to infinity as epsilon goes to zero. And one can even make that estimate explicit. Since my time is going out, has already passed, I won't do that. We get a completely different answer. The answer reverses discontinuously at the right at the unit circle configuration, at the very simplest configuration for which one ordinarily expects the stablest possible behavior, we get a discontinuous change in the answer, corresponding to infinitesimal changes of the configuration. In here, for any b, in the inner circle, for any b, we have always a positive answer, but just increase the radius of the circle by epsilon, and for small enough b, the answer is going to reverse, and it will reverse with an infinite change in the limiting behavior. We get a picture sort of like this. For a fixed point, take a fixed point in the domain. I plot b against epsilon. Out here, we get this relation. The inner thing is larger than the epsilon thing, which in turn is larger than the star, corresponding to a positive answer. But if I come into this domain, the star and epsilon relation reverses, and even the u epsilon minus u star is tending to minus infinity, or u star minus u epsilon tends to plus infinity as we go to b going to zero. But if I go to this axis in the in this kind of motion, then the u epsilon minus u star, well, I haven't proved this, but it turns out that tends to a constant. They're always the same constant, which is positive. So we get a very singular behavior at this corner point where the B and epsilon join. And I think, I'm sorry, I've exceeded my time. I do have to make the following remark. The material on which I've spoken is my own work, but on the other hand, it didn't come to me just out of the blue. I owe a very deep debt to some past literature. It's a natural development out of past literature. I've gotten very deep insight from I've gotten very deep insight from beautiful papers written by David Siegel. Also, there is a background in joint work I wrote with Cosmo Demyansky, in which we gave a somewhat more complicated form of this example. I think one of independent interest. And then there was related work that I did jointly with Darren Lee, and finally jointly with Victor Brady and Paul Conkus, we have verified or corroborated these results numerically. We've made numerical calculations in particular cases which show that this kind of behavior actually does occur. So I think it's more than, I've exceeded my time, I'm sorry. I should stop.
You did come up with a surprise at the end.
Well, for me it was certainly a surprise.
So there's the possibility of further questions. Maybe the questions, maybe people should have the opportunity to leave if the time has run a little late. But first I'd like to mention that the notice that went out this morning mentioned that for people who are interested, there will be some kind of dinner arranged this evening. And I guess you may have left names with Darren or otherwise with me. As you leave, you might approach me about that. So now, are there further questions?
Yeah. Physically, I would think that the surface tension acting on the surface would tell you that there's a total force upwards of proportional to the perimeter, and which has to equal the amount lifted, which would give you, I think that would give you Young's
formula. That leads to Young's formula.
And you say Young's formula is wildly off. That of course would just give you the mean height, but you say Young's formula is wildly off. What's happening? Well, where does that argument, physical argument, break down?
No, I don't think Young's formula is wildly off.
Well, you're off by a factor of many.
No, you're dividing by B, and
for large A.
Yeah,
for large radius.
Yeah.
No, fix the domain.
Yeah.
And Young's formula gives you something divided by B. which tells you both solutions are going off to infinity, both in the inner circle and in the outer polygonal domain. These solutions are going off to infinity, and what I'm doing is comparing these solutions, looking at the difference of heights between the solutions as they go off to infinity, and that's a higher order effect that isn't reflected in Young's formula.
In doing experiments, measuring capillary rise to deduce the surface tension is a good old physical chemistry experiment. The corrections to what you call Young's formula, one has to take into account the curve, the volume that is, because the surface is curved at the edge, you have to include the volume there, and that will change the formula. So that type of correction
is that really the only effect, or is that the only effect, or is there some other?
That's the only one that I know of. But then it would depend upon how big those changes would occur, as to whether there is a difference as to.
I don't know how to get these quantitative relations directly in that way, but perhaps one could reason that way.
Estimating all they're doing is estimating the total volume of the fluid lifted times the times gravity, and the total volume lifted is not only just the column. But there is also the estimating that there is a spherical surface is the standard at the top, including that the volume of the fluid in that.
I think there you would get into difficulty, because we're looking at values of B that are not zero, and these surfaces are not spherical.
These are estimates. They're not. You get, it's not exact, of course.
I think those estimates would not lead to this result.
No. I wasn't trying to say that. But these are that's where the large radius would differ from the experiment to Young's formula. That was the relevance that I was doing.
Yes.
You know, this is a different game.
Yeah.
Are there any questions? Suppose you have, as was asked earlier, a tube within a tube. Would the heights add?
Well, I'm not sure what would be meant by heights adding, because there's no clear level out. There's no horizontal level outside.
Well, no, this is in a big bath, and you put
I see.
At a certain height, now you put another opening of capillary inside that.
The inner height would be the same as you get with an infinite bath, but the outer height would be for a ring domain, for an annular domain. Because then you have capillary rise between two walls. These walls are forming an annulus. So you have an annular domain. No? You have one domain like this, and one domain like this, both of them situated in a bath. The inner one sees only the bath. But the outer one, you have two walls here. So you have a region with two walls, and you have an annular domain here between the two.
Which would give a rise to a height also.
That would have its own reason.
The second question is there ever a situation in the materials where U is negative?
As soon as gamma exceeds pi over 2, and that you have, for example, mercury in glass, you get about 140 or 150 degrees, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So then the water goes down. And that that theory reduces to this one. You make a transformation U onto minus U, and you can reduce that problem to this one. And so I've intimidated the audience.
If there are no further questions. I'm still confused on your questions.